you look at Menlo Park today and the US in general, it's a huge part of our investing. But for a number of years, we did very little.
That's Dipan Patel, co-managing partner and co-CEO of Permira, one of the few European domiciled firms that not only has a toehold in the US, it has established a footprint as large as the one back home.
We really are one of the very few scale GPs that have cracked both the US and Europe. It's about 50-50 in terms of our deployment into both regions. And it's also around 50-50 in terms of the returns.
Today on the show, we'll explore how Permira has been able to scale on both sides of the pond and what it takes to differentiate yourself in some of the world's most fiercely competitive markets.
It's messy as you do it. And I think what you need more than anything is phenomenal individual, and you need a duration mindset.
We'll then turn our attention to how Dipan is thinking about AI. I've had more conversations than I can count on this topic, but as you're about to hear, Dipan has an impressive, clear-eyed strategy. I'm Hugh MacArthur, chairman of Bain's Global Private Equity Practice, and this is Dry Powder. Dipan, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on today.
Pleasure to be here, and thank you for the invite.
You know, I think it'd be fascinating for our audience if you told us a little bit about your unusually deep purview into multiple markets, not just as a firm, but personally, you've worked in the U.S. as well as Europe. And as you know, spreading geographically was really one of the first ways that buyout firms moved and expanded their business over time. And I remember in the 90s when the first American domiciled firms were going over to Europe, they felt like, well, if I just plant a flag in London, I'll be able to do deals all over Europe, and it'll be easy to do deals in Italy and Germany. And they found out pretty quickly that that's not the way that Europe operates. And as you well know, the European markets and the US markets are actually quite different. Yeah, European markets are more sponsor-to-sponsor driven. They focus on slightly different asset classes, and the US is very, very large. And it's been very challenging to find any European domiciled investor in any private asset class that's really become substantial and successful in the US market. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on how Permira has successfully been able to scale its operations in the US over time and talk a little bit about that journey since you have such a unique purview.
Yeah. So I would start with people. Mm-hmm. The first thing is we hired Tom Lister, John Coyle in New York, and we hired Brian Ruder on the West Coast. We actually sent out to the West Coast in particular one of our most prolific deal people. So Richard Sanders took his young family out to the West Coast and helped develop that office. And, you know, many firms will send people to those regions. Not many of them will send their best people. Mm-hmm. In the moment, would be much better served in the area that they are in. But over a longer term view, the trade-off makes sense. And so we spent a lot of time also just learning the market and entrusting and empowering the people there on the ground. Mm-hmm. These satellite initiatives where you have a sort of very powerful HQ and you try to make all the decisions from the HQ and undermine people out there at the edge never work. So we hired great people and we backed their judgment. We moved at a pace that was frankly slow, boring, methodical, and compounded over time. Like you look at Menlo Park today and the US in general, it's a huge part of our investing. But for a number of years, we did very little. It would have looked like we were doing nothing, but we were building relationships, building networks, building IP, building a brand, cycling through lots of reps. And when we decided to lean in, we got that multiplier effect.
I think learning the market is one of the critical things that you said, because the markets are different. And I take your point that it's unusual to send your best people. Going to the West Coast and the East Coast is also relatively unique. European domiciled investor, all of those resonate with me. The learning part of the market is also a big one. If I could use a golf analogy, a lot of investors, when they come to this market for the first time, they tend to underclub it. This is not a massive sponsor-to-sponsor market. It certainly wasn't 20 years ago. It was very, very small. And you know a few sponsors and everybody knows what's coming for sale. That is not the U.S. market. The U.S. market has hundreds of intermediaries. You need to build networks. You need to know people. You need to figure out how the deal markets actually work and what relationships you need to actually source transactions. So that learning and figuring out how do we do business in this market with our best people on both coasts seems like a really good move. And you do need to be patient. And I guess the proof is in the pudding, because about half of your business, as you said, is in the US now, as well as the other half in Europe.
Absolutely. And I would say that any time in our firm's history we've done anything fast, we've regretted it. Slow compounding is my favorite way of running a business. And it tends to not generate outcomes in the short term, but then end up generating exponential type progress in the outer years. Mm-hmm. What is harder to say is, you know, is there a turning point where we just know? And I think the truthful answer is there isn't. We take the leap of faith on the first investment. Then the story unfolds from there. We've had scenarios where that first thing doesn't work out well. And it's a very short story. Then we have stories like sending Richard to Menlo Park, hiring Brian, making our first investment. And after 6 to 12 months, that looking like a really in the money investment. Mm-hmm. And then you do your second and your third, and then suddenly your fourth, fifth and sixth come pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you develop a institutional confidence. The partner on the ground develops confidence. And more importantly than that, you develop a industry reputation, a stock of management teams that will reference you well, and a patent recognition flywheel around value creation. And all of that just spins faster and faster and faster, and you end up creating great businesses over time. Now, as I say, because we're human beings and because we're storytelling machines, all of that always can be romanticized, I think, with the benefit of history, but it's messy as you do it. And I think what you need more than anything is phenomenal individual, and you need a duration mindset, mm-hmm. right? It's so easy to call time on things in our industry because we're not like a retailer,
right?
You know, like retailers move on a weekly cadence, frankly, a daily cadence, and you can sort of push a button and see whether it works or not. We push a button and we see over months and multiple years sometimes whether we've made the right decisions or not. And that's just the nature of the industry. And so the temptation to call time on stuff because it looks like it's not working is always there and ever present in our business. And I think one of the things that Brian and I spend a lot of time thinking about is, you know, is this thing not working or does this thing need more time?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good way to think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. Now, there are a lot of technology investors, obviously, in the United States. What did Permira do to differentiate itself in technology investing and become successful given all of that competition?
So if you look at technology, it's probably about 35-40% of what we do is just pure software investing. Over the last 15 years, we've deployed about $20 billion. We have a gross IRR of about 30%. Gross realized return way in excess of 3 times the money. So just a very, very successful cornerstone of what we've done. There are a number of firms that are tech specialists, and there are firms that are generalists but have reasonably strong sector teams within tech. And so it's been crucial for us to just locate our swim lane and where we have an edge over the competition. I think the first is in category leading businesses with phenomenal products where the bet is actually doubling down on the product, mm-hmm. and bending the growth curve rather than milking a product to grow margins. Mm-hmm. That's one. The second is technology companies, software companies who are in the US and trying to grow in Europe, or in Europe trying to grow in the US. We invested in a company called Clearwater a few years ago, and they ran a narrowish process in the first round, and the entire second round process was about showing European credentials. And they picked a part based on how they could help grow in Europe. And we ended up being selected really amongst a bunch of parties who were at the same price on that asset. So mm-hmm. that's another kind of core part of where we tend to differentiate. These are probably the two biggest areas. And I think just give you a couple of examples. We invested in a company called Informatica. Mm-hmm. We sold a few months ago to Salesforce.com. It was a $9 billion exit. And Bain actually helped us a lot during the diligence and the value creation there. But we built from scratch a business in cloud that has ended up being about $1 billion in revenue, or will be $1 billion in revenue this year with very significant growth. Another business we exited this year fully was P&I, mm-hmm. HR software space in Germany. We transitioned about 80% of the base to our cloud offering through our ownership period. You know, these are like market leading businesses with great products, where the bet was doubling down on the product rather than taking the businesses to maximum EBITDA margin as quickly as possible.
So great businesses where there's still a lot of runway.
That's right.
So I think I understand tech, but beyond tech, what other sectors or geographies do you really see as opportunities today?
We are tech first, but not tech only. You know, what does that mean in practice? It means 35-40% of our investing is software, but the other 60-65% is in healthcare, consumer, and services. Predominantly, we will invest where technology is a core part of the value creation program. Increasingly, what that means is automation, and that automation is going to come in the form of AI and AI diffusion and implementation across those portfolio companies.
Right.
Historically, I mean, just give you examples, we have lent into consumer brands where there's been a big online thesis over the last decade. So we invested in Doc Martens. Hopefully someone on this call owns a pair. That business online as a percentage of revenue was 5-10% when we invested. About a third of it is online today. Mm-hmm. We're in a company called Golden Goose today. It's luxury footwear space. That was in the 5-10% region. Today is also about a third of its revenue is online. And that has taken the resource of folks in our tech team and our tech operating team to enable. Within services, we have taken a number of businesses in the professional services space with large white collar headcount. Mm-hmm. And sought ways to automate processes in those companies, mostly, by the way, with the goal of accelerating revenue growth rather than just dropping that through to margin, just freeing up people to do more complex work or offer more complex services that can grow the share of wallet within our customers. And then equally within healthcare, this is an area that's historically been quite slow to adopt technology.
Right.
I think will change very significantly, we think, over the next decade or so. So we're very excited about the intersection of tech and healthcare.
So tech, but not tech only, but it's good to have tech inside some of the other sectors that you're talking about because you see potentially the same doubling down kind of possibilities in those areas as well.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
No, it sounds very sensible. You mentioned, Dipan, AI a little bit earlier, yep. And I wanted to return to that topic. Are there areas within AI, I mean, so much of what you do, as we've discussed, has been tech-infused. Are there areas specifically within AI where you are seeing unique opportunities today, either in sourcing transactions or underwriting, or once you own something, getting that value that we were talking about? But where do you see some of the more exciting areas where AI is really going to leapfrog in the next few years?
Sure. This is a huge topic. It's also a very amorphous topic. Mm-hmm. You know, I think most people today are sort of wandering around in the dark, you know, without a flashlight. And our approach and our view on this will probably be the single most important factor over the next 10 to 15 years in everything we do across our portfolio, our new investing, and the way that we make investing decisions. It represents probably a platform shift. And platform shifts tend to be important big deal events in technology. If you go back and look at mainframe, client server, PC, internet, mobile, all of these things ended up creating big infrastructure layers and then thousands of apps on top of them and just totally changing the game for industries. And then these things take time to play out. But when they do, they seem sort of obvious with hindsight, and AI feels like that. To us today, however early it is. So I think that's the, let's call it the master statement and the way that we think about AI and the importance that we place on it. Then as an investing firm, we've got our direct investing. Like, what do we invest in today? And there is our portfolio. If I start with the latter first, I think on the portfolio, there is the bottom half of the P&L, top half of the P&L. And the bottom half of the P&L is probably where the game's being played in a scaled way. Because we are so heavy in tech, both in our pure play software investments and our tech-enabled businesses across our other sectors, we tend to carry big product and tech organizations right across our 80 portfolio companies, across our growth and buyout funds. Mm-hmm. And if you just think about software development, you just think about that one thing by itself. Software development has really never in history been this cheap to develop.
Right.
It will also never be this expensive to develop ever again. Mm-hmm. So it is on a on a curve, and it will have massive ramifications for us across our portfolio. And we're just at the early stages of assessing, evaluating, adopting the right tools and scaling them through our product and tech functions in our portfolio. Mm-hmm. I could then make the same comments for customer support, marketing, and a number of other areas. But these are all sort of, let's call it bottom half of the P&L topics. And 2026 budgets are going to be really interesting. And we're very, very focused on working with our portfolio companies to scale and deliver on the promise. The harder work is the top half of the P&L. And this is really about weaving AI into all the core workflows across our products and services. And that's clunky and much harder, I think, than people care to admit or talk about. But it's coming and will be transformational for the people that can figure this out early enough and then figure out how to scale it. So that's sort of the other piece. In our direct investing, you know, where are we investing today? You know, if you take AI and just dumb it down for a second and think of it as energy, compute, data models, and apps, just take those four layers. At the compute / infra level, we have invested in our growth funds, in a land banking company, a company that has very unique access to powered land. Mm-hmm. In our flagship fund, we have backed a data center rollout in the US, really just playing this compute and infra theme.
Sure.
We will not invest in the sort of model layer. The most valuable companies in the world will probably be created at that layer, but there will be very, very few of them. Mm-hmm. And it will be at a scale venture and strategic game. And then the app layer is probably the most interesting over time. These businesses still sit in venture land. They're more interesting to our portfolio companies as M&A targets today. And the areas that we are sort of most focused on in investing are businesses that have access to unique data. So this is data not available in general training sets that could be used to embed and improve the core product and often generate new use cases that can be monetized. So anywhere really across software and internet in particular, where we have that kind of data lock-in, we're really excited and we'll be building them back in companies.
I think that's a very sensible way to think about it. And frankly, that's one of the clearest ways of thinking about it I've heard explained. And I do a lot of talking and interviewing about AI. So thank you for that, Deepan. On the next episode of Dry Powder, we'll unpack Permira's approach to value creation.
We like to underlever, overgrow, and undermargin our businesses. And so we built a entire value creation effort around doing that and generally been paid for that when we've come to exit our businesses.
I'm Hugh MacArthur. Thank you for listening.